91. As if you open your Bibles this morning, book of Genesis chapter 4, book of Genesis chapter 4. We're going to get there eventually. It'll be a little while, but we will get there. Genesis chapter 4 in your Bibles this morning. While you're finding Genesis chapter 4, do a little bit of housekeeping to get started this morning. 3 weeks from last Friday begins our annual teen weekend here, and we've already given some of these flyers out to the high school class this morning. They're available at the back of the auditorium in the foyer on both the tables back there. Encourage all parents for junior high and high school this year. Junior high and high school. Teen weekend starts 3 weeks from Friday. Hope that you'll put it on your calendars. Hopefully it's already been on your calendars, and you'll be making plans to attend. We want to encourage our young people to be bringing their friends from school, friends from other congregations, friends from camp, friends from the neighborhood, wherever you've got friends, bring them with you, junior high and the high school young people. Look forward to having you here with us. One of the things that is not clear on the flyer that I just realized this morning, the Sunday morning class, 9 a.m., Ben Lee will be with us from Dallin Road. Ben Lee will be with us to do Teen Weekend this year. That Sunday morning 9 a.m. lesson, that's for high school only. Adult classes go on like normal. That's not clear on the flyer. But we need to be clear on that so there's no confusion. It is just the high school class, 9 a.m., that Ben Lee will be talking to. The rest of us will be doing what we'll usually be doing at that time. This year, we're calling it, We War Not Against Flesh and Blood, an idea taken from Ephesians chapter 6, verses 11 through 13. We don't often keep sight of the fact that one of the great metaphors in the Bible is the war metaphor, that we are at war against Satan. And whether we realize it or not, Satan's at war against us. And so we certainly want our young people to realize that the struggle is real and that we need to take seriously the danger and the struggle against sin in which we are engaged, as well as the very real possibility, if we are faithful to Jesus, that the reality, the hope, that we will experience victory at the end of the war in the last day when Jesus comes back and Satan is cast into hell and those who have followed Jesus and made war with him against the works of the devil are vindicated in the end. And so Saturday or Friday night, Ben will keynote for us the idea from Ephesians 6 that we are at war, spiritual war, whether we realize it or not. Saturday, the sessions that we're going to have on Saturday, we're calling the front lines, issues for today's teens. Some issues that Ben has helped us pick out that are particularly applicable to young people, so we're calling it the front lines, where Satan makes war against our young people. And there are a number of topics that we will be talking about over the course of Saturday's sessions. And then Sunday, 9 a.m., the high school class will meet with Ben. They'll talk about be bold and courageous, where Ben wants to end on an optimistic note on Sunday. And 10 a.m. and 5 p.m., just some outstanding ideas, Ben's 10 a.m. lesson, thankfulness, an overlooked tactic to overcoming sin. And Ben's got some great ideas from the Bible and wants to talk to us about for that lesson. And then we'll end the weekend with defeating the devil as a family. And so it's a good weekend that's planned. Ben is a capable speaker and a talented young man, and we look forward to having Ben with us. On the logistics side, those of you who are parents of junior high and high school young people, do reach out to Dean Bedham. Dean's the deacon who is helping us with the logistics for Teen Weekend. Reach out to Dean and be whatever service you can be to him. He would appreciate it. I would appreciate it. And it would be good for our young people to see as many of us as possible involved in making this happen. Look forward to a great weekend. If you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to me. And I'll be happy to answer whatever questions I can. But get those flyers, make your plans, bring your friends, and let's have a great teen week in April 21st to the 23rd. All right. I have for some time been collecting essays and articles, books, on the role and the impact of technology, particularly the internet and now smartphones, are having on us as a society collectively and on us as individuals specifically. One of the trends that I've noticed in recent times is that even the secular culture, the larger world around us, as godless as it is starting to ask questions about what all this internet, constant interconnectivity on all the time, what this new reality, this social media reality, what it's doing to us, particularly through our smartphones, how it's changing us. And even the secular world is starting to ask, is all of this good? Is all this where we want to go? We as Christians, we tend to worry, we tend to view, we tend to think about technology and its role in our lives in merely the smallest possible scale. We worry about whether something is right or wrong. You know, for instance, pornography is wrong. We get that, and so we avoid that, and we counsel our children. We try to protect our children from falling victim to that through technology and through the internet. And that's for most of us. That's kind of where, as Christians, our consideration of this issue begins and ends. We don't ask the question of right or wrong with enough context. We don't think about technology in the larger scope, in the big picture. How does technology and my use of technology and its role in my life, how is it helping or hurting others? Where will this lead? Not just is it right or wrong, but where will this lead? Where will my children, who inevitably take things a step further than I do, where will they go with the technology habits and the technology values that they're picking up from me? What deep assumptions that maybe I don't even realize I've had, maybe I need to stop and think about how I'm being shaped of this. What deep assumptions or views are affecting me? Or am I maybe, without even realizing it, endorsing in what I do and how I use technology? There was a mid-20th century media studies academic scholar named Marshall McLuhan who noted that the medium inescapably becomes part of the message. How you hear about something, how you learn something, how you view something, how you watch something is part of the message. And McLuhan's point back in the mid-20th century already, before the internet was even around, except in those secret shadowy military installations, McLuhan recognized that the medium, the technology, shapes us. And even more so, the technology will shape how we receive or understand the concept or what's being communicated. And so the point is that even the larger secular world realizes we have to ask not just is it right or is it wrong in and of itself for me individually. We have to think about technology in the larger macro scale as well. It's interesting. There are a number of articles. I just picked a few this morning to even reference. Already back in 2008, Nicholas Carr wrote an article, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And yes, that's spelled correctly. That's the point. He wrote at one point in this essay, he said, "My mind isn't going, so far as I can tell, but it's changing. I'm not thinking the way I used to think. I can feel it most strongly when I'm reading. Immersing myself in a book or a lengthy article used to be easy. My mind would be caught up in the narrative or the turns of the argument, and I'd spend hours strolling through long stretches of prose. That's rarely the case anymore. Now my concentration often starts to shift after two or three pages. I get fidgety. I lose the thread. I begin looking for something else to do. I feel as if I'm always dragging my wayward brain back to the text. The deep reading that used to come naturally has become a struggle." And probably only those of us over a certain age will even understand what he's talking about. And how reading on the internet, reading in short clips and hyperlinked text where you click and you change all the time, it's affecting us. That was 2008. More recently, in some circles, widely remarked upon essay last fall, Andrew Sullivan in New York Magazine in the fall of 2016, in a piece called "My Distraction Sickness and Yours." And by the way, you've got to understand who Andrew Sullivan is. Andrew Sullivan is a journalist who more or less invented professional blogging back at the turn of the millennium. That's fun to say. Back at the turn of the millennium, about 2000, 2001, first made journalistic blogging economically viable and ran that blog until about 2013, 2014, for about 14, 15 years straight. Sullivan, then stunning the media world, quit his blog, which had become an icon in journalistic circles. Quit it. Cold turkey. He writes about it a couple years later, and he says, "I tried reading books, but that skill now began to elude me. After a couple of pages, my fingers twitched for a keyboard. I tried meditation, but my mind bucked and bridled as I tried to still it. I got a steady workout routine, and it gave me the only relief I could measure for an hour or so a day. But over time, in this pervasive virtual world, the online clamor grew louder and louder. Although I spent hours each day, alone and silent, attached to a laptop, it felt as if I were in a constant cacophonous crowd of words and images, sounds and ideas, emotions and tirades, a wind tunnel of deafening, deadening noise. So much of it was irresistible, as I fully understood." You ever feel that way about your Facebook account? "So much of the technology was irreversible, as I also knew." In other words, we're not going back. We're not putting the genie back in the bottle. But I'd begun to fear that this new way of living was actually becoming a way of not living. By the last few months of full-time professional blogging as a journalist, I realized that I had been engaged, like most addicts, in a form of denial. I'd long treated my online life as a supplement to my real life, an add-on, as it were. Yes, I spent many hours communicating with others as a disembodied voice, but my real life and body were still here. But then I began to realize, as my health and my happiness deteriorated, that this was not a both-and kind of situation. It was either-or. Every hour I spent online was not spent in the physical world. Every minute I was engrossed in a virtual interaction, I was not involved in a human encounter. Every second absorbed in some trivial or some trivia was a second less for any form of reflection or calm or spirituality. Multitasking was a mirage. This was a zero-sum question. I either lived as a voice online or I lived as a human being in the world that humans had lived in since the beginning of time. And so I decided, after 15 years, to live in reality. What writers like Carr and especially Sullivan described, as Sullivan himself admits, is a form of addiction, that we are becoming addicted without even realizing it to our technology, to our social media, to our devices, to our online experiences, sometimes without even realizing it, some of us even coming to prefer that to actual embodied human interaction the way God made us. Both Carr and Sullivan acknowledge, as I do as well, the benefits of technology. But both of them have noticed that this time there is something fundamentally going on with what this new technological revolution is doing to us. And it's interesting, it's gotten to the point where you can also find voices in the larger world, the secular world, beginning to wonder what all this is doing to our children who have never known a different world. You realize the iPhone came out in 2007. I had to explain to Abby what a dial tone was the other day. No idea. She laughed when she heard that phones used to be plugged into the wall, because we've been that long without a landline now. And so it's interesting. The New York Times, hardly a bastion of religious sensibility, the New York Times' Nick Bilton, in a September 2014 piece titled "Steve Jobs Was a Low-Tech Parent," and I want you to think about this. Bilton writes this: "So, your kids must love the iPad," I asked Mr. Jobs, trying to change the subject because Jobs had called him about something else. The company's first tablet was just hitting the shelves. "They haven't used it," he told me. "We limit how much technology our kids use at home." This is Steve Jobs. Apple, maybe you've heard of him. "Since then," Bilton goes on to write, "since then, I've met a number of technology chief executives and venture capitalists who say similar things. They strictly limit their children's screen time, often banning all gadgets on school nights and allowing ascetic time limits on weekends." Chris Anderson, the former editor of Wired and now chief executive of 3D Robotics, a drone maker, has instituted time limits and parental controls on every device in his home. Quote, "My kids accuse me and my wife of being fascists and overly concerned about tech, and they say that none of their friends have the same rules," end quote. He said of his five children, ages 6 to 17. "That's because we have seen the dangers of technology firsthand." This is a guy in Silicon Valley saying this. "I've seen it myself, and I don't want it to happen to my kids." The dangers he is referring to include exposure to harmful content like pornography, bullying from other kids known as cyberbullying, and perhaps worse of all, becoming addicted to their devices just like their parents. Alex Constantinople, the chief executive of Outcast Agency, a tech-focused communications and marketing firm, said her youngest son, who is 5, is never allowed to use gadgets during the week, and her older children, 10 to 13, are allowed only 30 minutes a day on school nights. Evan Williams, a founder of Blogger, Twitter, maybe you've heard of that, and Medium, and his wife, Sarah Williams, said that in lieu of iPads, their two young boys have hundreds of books, yes, physical ones, that they can pick up and read anytime. Some parents also forbid teenagers from using social networks, except for services like Snapchat, which deletes messages after they have been sent. This way they don't have to worry about saying something online that will haunt them later in life, one executive told me. Well, that's part of the problem with Snapchat as well. On the flip side is it gives your kids a way to cover their tracks. Although some non-tech parents I know, Bilton writes, give smartphones to children as young as 8, many who work in tech wait until their child is 14. While these teenagers can make calls and text, they are not given a data plan until 16. But there was one rule that is universal among the tech parents I polled. This is rule number one, quote, "There is no screen in the bedroom, period, ever," said Chris Anderson, editor, former editor of Wired magazine. Here's Bilton's conclusion, his final paragraph. "I never asked Mr. Jobs what his children did instead of using the gadgets that he built. So I reached out instead to Walter Isaacson, the author of Steve Jobs, a definitive biography, who spent a lot of time in Jobs' home." Isaacson's answer: "Every evening, Steve made a point of having dinner at a big long table in her kitchen, discussing books and history and a variety of things," he said. "No one ever pulled out an iPad or a computer. The kids did not seem addicted to all these devices." One last example. Matt Richtel, also in the New York Times, October 2011, a Silicon Valley school that doesn't compute. "Mr. Alan Eagle knows a bit about technology. He holds a computer science degree from Dartmouth and works in executive communications at Google, where he has written speeches for the chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt. He personally uses an iPad and a smartphone, but he says his daughter, a fifth grader, doesn't know how to use Google, the company that he works for and pays his bills. And his son is just learning." Talk about a school where these tech parents send their kids. "And where advocates for stocking classrooms with technology say children need computer time to compete in the modern world, Waldorf," that's the name of the school, "Waldorf school parents counter, what's the rush, given how easy it is to pick up those skills? It's super easy," one parent said. "It's like learning to use toothpaste. At Google and all these places, we make technology as brain-dead easy to use as possible. There's no reason why kids can't figure it out when they get older." The students, meanwhile, say they don't pine for technology, nor have they gone completely cold turkey. It's not one extreme or the other. Andy Eagle and her fifth-grade classmates say they occasionally watch movies. One girl, whose father works as an Apple engineer, says he sometimes asks her to test games he is debugging. One boy plays with a flight simulator program on the weekends. The students say they can become frustrated when their parents and relatives get so wrapped up in their phones and other devices. That's the kids who have not been conditioned to this, talking to their tech-addicted parents. One child, 11 years old, said he recently went to visit cousins and found himself sitting around with five of them playing with their gadgets, not paying attention to him or each other. And so he started waving his arms at them, saying, I'm here, guys, hello. And that's just a secular world. That's people who make this stuff for a living and develop these products, saying, almost like drug dealers, "It's fine for your kids, it's not okay for mine." My point this morning, let me be very clear, let me be very, very clear, let me be explicit as I can about this. My point this morning is not to legislate how technology should be used in your house. It's not my point. No desire to do that. I'm not interested in laying down any rules. I'm not interested in setting any age ranges or anything like that. I'm not interested in laying out any age about when your kids can have smartphones or start using the internet or how you do that. I'm more interested in making us all more intentional and aware about how technology is affecting us, to the point that even the geniuses of Silicon Valley are saying, wow, I don't want that for my kid. So that we might best protect ourselves and our children from something that, while not morally wrong in and of itself, has the immense potential for great evil. It's interesting, you know, when you begin to flip through publications like this, which again are hardly places that take Christianity seriously. Honestly, they're places that ridicule it. I find my mind going back to something Jesus once said in Luke 16 and verse 8, that the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. Sometimes the people of the world put more thought and the how they're living in the world and with the things of the world than the people of God do. And I think that that quick sampling of stuff I've collected over the years is just an example of that, that we need to be careful. Sometimes Jesus warned us that the sons of darkness are wiser than the sons of light. Maybe something like that's going on here when it comes to technology. Too often, as Christians and as parents, we focus on the legitimate point, and our argument simply is, there's nothing wrong with the thing in and of itself. And that's true. But where, as Paul reminds us, all things may be lawful, not all things are expedient or profitable. There's another question in life, Paul reminds us of 1 Corinthians. There's another question in life that we need to ask besides, is it morally acceptable? We also need to ask, is it wise? Too often we just ask, is it right or is it wrong? As long as it's right, we put no further thought to it and we just jump in both feet. Paul says there's something more to ask. You must ask, is it right or is it wrong? And you must come to the conclusion, biblically speaking, that something is right. But there's another question you've got to ask. What's wise? What's profitable? What's expedient? And that's a more complicated question, isn't it? But that's a question that Paul advises, but we too often fail to take into account. On one level, the issue is moderation. Just like diet and exercise. Too much exercise, you'll hurt yourself. Just like food, you know, most doctors will tell you the reason diets don't work is because too many diets want you to give up everything that's good and fun and tastes great. Most doctors will tell you, unless you've got an extreme health situation, the key is not that you have to give up all sugar or all chocolate or whatever it is. It's just enjoy it in moderation, right? That's the real issue in life, being wise about what we do. The problem is, we're just Americans. In our society, in our culture, we don't know how to do moderation. All we do is excess. Have you seen football stadiums lately? You know how much money the NCAA tournament's raking in? And it's just a game. We throw a ball through a metal hoop. Now listen, I like it. I'm going to watch the game Monday night. But think about it. We've taken child's games and built an economy around them that's bigger than a lot of nations' GDP. We Americans don't do anything in moderation. All we know is excess, and that's part of the problem here. We don't know how to avoid two extremes, or we sit there and say, I just won't do it at all then. Well, technology, there's nothing wrong with technology in of itself, but we got to avoid the opposite extreme, and too many of us as parents are not stopping to think about the excess of the world in this area to a point that, again, even Steve Jobs raised his eyebrows and said, not for my kids, not in my house. Over the next couple of Sundays, today and next Sunday night, I want to talk with you about technology. Today I want to do big picture. I want to do big picture biblical perspective. It's going to take us to Genesis 4 here in just a moment. I want to do the big picture biblical perspective. Some things about technology from the Bible's perspective that maybe you haven't noticed or thought about before. Next Sunday night, I want to talk a little bit more specifically about our own situation with technology. I want to talk about internet, smartphones in particular, and try to make some observations from the Bible about what the wisdom that we need and what's going on in the time and place, especially for those of us who are parents and have children. But this morning, let's do the big picture. Let's talk about technology from the biggest possible picture. Genesis chapter 4, remember, Cain kills Abel. Cain kills Abel in Genesis chapter 4, where I've asked you to open your Bible this morning. And God pronounces a judgment upon Cain in Genesis chapter 4 for killing Abel. Rather than putting Cain to death, God pronounces this judgment upon Cain, who had previously, up to that point, been a farmer, somebody who made his living from the ground growing crops. Now you are cursed from the ground, God said to Cain, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. That's what God says to Cain right there. No longer are you going to be able to grow food. You can't be a farmer and you can't stay in one place anymore. You are to wander. Kind of hard to grow crops when you got to pick up and move every so often, isn't it? But that's God's curse upon Cain. No longer will the ground produce food for you, and you must wander. So Cain being Cain, what does Cain go out and do towards the end of the chapter, verse 17? Well, Cain decides, picking up in verse 17, to build a city. I don't know about you, but can you wander, accept your punishment when you're building a city? But Cain's rebellion continues. Cain knew his wife. She conceived, and she bore a man named Enoch. When Cain built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. How's that for an in-your-face to God? Not only am I going to stay put, I'm going to build a city. I'm going to name it after my son. My line continues. I snuffed Abel out, but my line goes on. And it goes on to list some of the children of Cain. And Cain's family gave us all sorts of gifts to human civilization, like eventually a descendant named Lamech who took two wives. That's one of Cain's line's great claims. It invented polygamy and bigamy. That's what Cain's line produces. With that kind of an attitude, with that kind of a father, grandfather, great-grandfather, what else would you expect? But then it gets interesting. Some of Cain's other descendants, one was Yabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. In other words, Yabal develops the concept of what we now call animal husbandry, agribusiness. He had a brother whose name was Yubal. And he was the father of all those who played the lyre and the pipe. In other words, that branch of Cain's family develops what we now know as music. And finally, there was a young man born Tubal, Cain. And he was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. In other words, he invented developed metallurgy, making things, smelting things. Now, what's interesting about those types of things is that that's really the beginning of technology, of human technology. Technology is not computers. Technology is skill at taking the things of the earth and through human ingenuity improving them or making something out of them to make them more useful for human purposes. That's technology. And so making a hammer, a hammer is technology. It is taking something of the earth, some wood, some metal, and I make a tool out of it that increases my productivity, my efficiency, and what I can accomplish. That's technology. And what the Bible is saying is that technology as such develops in the line of Cain. It develops in a man who basically said, in your face to God, you want me to wander? I'm going to build a city, and my line will never die. I'm going to name the city after my son. My line goes on. And we do what we do. And when you stop and think about it, there's nothing wrong in and of itself with music. But when you stop and think about the nature of technology and even the branches of technology that the Bible cites that Cain's line develops, it could be used for good, it could be used for evil. Music can, on the one hand, be Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven. Or it can be Lady Gaga and orgies. Metallurgy, industry, manufacturing. We can build plows and make things out of metal. We can also build swords and spears. Nuclear technology today. Nuclear medicine saves lives. Nuclear bombs can snuff out infinitely more in a moment. Part of what the Bible is trying to say is that while, yes, technology as such is morally neutral, in human hands more often than not, what does it become? It becomes evil. And then particularly in Cain's line, what does technology's purpose serve? To try to avoid the implications of God's curse rather than to accept it. Every once in a while today, you'll see a cover on Time Magazine or one of the periodicals, you know, the cure for cancer, the cure for aging, the cure for death is just around the corner. We're going to get it. That's a Cain-type claim for technology. Last time I checked, God's already solved the problem of death, and the name of the solution to death is Jesus of Nazareth. Not a pill, not a medicine, not a treatment. It's not the thing itself. It's your view about the thing. It's how you turn to the thing. It's what you think about the thing. It's what you do with the thing. And in particular, the fact that Yabal and Yubal don't have the moniker that Tubal does. Tubal Cain reminds us, especially that metalworking, more often than not, what did that become? It became Cain-like in its implication. Violence, death, swords, spears. The problem with technology is that we generally will turn it to evil ends. And like sin, we often become enslaved to it. The story goes on in Genesis. Genesis 5, Genesis 6, eventually there's a line of Seth as well. Seth's line is godly. And eventually it gets so bad it comes to the flood, though. It comes to the flood. Even Seth's line is corrupted by Cain's line and the sin of Cain's line. So God destroys the world. Starts over with a guy called Noah. Noah comes off the ark in Genesis chapter 9. God tells Noah the same thing he told Adam, be fruitful and multiply. In other words, Noah, I'm starting over with you. The one common descendant all of us have in this room together. We all came from Adam, we all came from Noah. Noah is the new Adam. God tries to start the story over, so to speak, with Noah. But before long, he hit Genesis chapter 11. And now, just like in the days of Noah, all humanity was united in rebellion against God. Guess what we find in Genesis chapter 11? In Genesis chapter 11, we find another familiar story. But just like the days of Noah was right before the flood, as humanity grew in its wickedness, the line of Cain eventually swallowing up the righteousness of the line of Seth. Once again, all humanity is united in rebellion against God. Now, the whole earth was one language, had the same words. And as a people, they migrated from the east. They found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to one another, come, let's make bricks, burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, bitumen for mortar. And they said, come, let us build a tower. Or excuse me, let's build a city. Now, what happens in the Bible when we build cities, generally speaking? What's the lesson of Cain? Cities, there's nothing wrong with them in and of themselves, but more often than not, it's going to be like moving to Sodom. Cities in Genesis were generally started by rebellious human beings. To engage in further rebellion against God. Cain had the first city, now comes another city. Let's build ourselves a city with a tower. Its top goes up into the heavens. Let's make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord God came down to the city, to the tower, which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose will now be impossible for them. So come, let's go down, confuse their language, so they may not understand one another's speech. And so the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, the name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. Whenever humanity gets together and starts a one humanity project, bad things happen in the Bible. That's what Babel's saying. And you will notice in verse 4, what the nature of their product was. We focus, especially in our kids' classes, we talk about the tower up in the heavens. They want to go up and replace God. Symbolically, that's part of it. But here's the bigger issue. They want to make a name for themselves. They want to make a name for themselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the earth. And so God confuses the language, and God accomplishes what God's purposes were. He wants them dispersed over the earth because, as verse 6 points out, when they get together with one language and one purpose, what does humanity do? Well, it starts to look like the days of Noah again. Bad things happen. The lesson of the flood was not learned. Humanity again began to build a city, a universal human city, with a tower to the heavens and the intention to make a name. Making a name is a big ideal in the Bible, right? Especially in Genesis. Who named the animals? Adam did. Who named Adam? Who named Adam? God did. Because to name somebody was to define their nature. Why did Adam name the woman Eve? Because he said she's the mother of all living. To name something in the Bible was to define its character and to have authority over it. Adam could name the animals. Adam could name Eve as his wife, and he's the husband. But who named Adam? God did. And now here's humanity saying, let's make a name for ourselves. Let's decide what we want to be as humans. Let's redefine who and what we are. And in our day, in our time, in our place, if you don't doubt the power, the symbolic power of naming, then I want you to notice in the LGBT movement why there's the use of gender-inclusive pronouns now, Z and Ze and Zem. And if you don't know what that is, ask your college student. They can probably tell you about it. It's coming. We'll change the language because he and she are too binary. Z, Z, Zem. Let's rename ourselves. Let's redefine what we are. Gender is arbitrary. We're doing it again today. We just don't realize it. Ecclesiastes, the preacher, saw this 3,000 years ago, that this is part of what makes us humans in our rebellion against God. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and he is not able to dispute with the one who is stronger than he. Man's already been named by God. That's why we know what we are. He's named us. He's called us what we are. He's told us what we are. He named Adam. They tried to argue with God and make a name for themselves and just make their own name. God thwarted that. You can't dispute with the God who is bigger than all. I find it interesting, ladies and gentlemen, that the time that we live in what I think today is the electronic version of the Tower of Babel. You ever thought about the internet that way? The electronic version of the Tower of Babel. Technology does, if we're not careful, it does bring with it, and certainly the secular culture sees technology as providing a sense of control over nature. A sense of confidence, false confidence. But think about the nature of the internet and cable and satellite TV now. Not since Genesis chapter 11, since God scattered humanity, not since Genesis chapter 11 has humanity been able to interact with each other, communicate with each other in real time. You ever thought about that? Not since Genesis chapter 11, but in our own day and time, that's what it looks like now. We now, around the world, a couple of you were in Israel recently, and I was sitting in my home office, and we were texting with each other. Isn't that scary when you stop and think about it? Halfway across the globe, and we're sitting there texting with each other. Technology primarily changes the world through how it changes how we communicate and how we transport ourselves. Internet's all about communication. Remember when you had to pay for long-distance calls? And everybody under 20 wonders, what's a long-distance call? Why do we have those three digits in front of our phone numbers? They make no sense. They're arbitrary now. Remember when you had to make a long distance? Remember when you had to pay for long distance calls? Remember those? Remember when you had to make that call on a phone plugged into the wall when you did it? And remember how really, really expensive it was when you did it? I think it was back when we were all drinking tab when it used to be like that. But the summer before my last year of college, Amanda and I had just gotten engaged. I was leaving for a summer training program with a church up in Indiana that summer. And Amanda was going to spend the summer with her parents in a suburb north of Fort Worth. And at the end of that summer, I didn't have any money left. And it wasn't because the church I was with was paying me that unfairly or that poorly. It was because that summer I spent all the money I made paying off the loan I took out to buy Amanda's engagement ring and paying for all those long-distance phone bills we racked up. And in hindsight, I think actually the ring loan was the cheaper of the two. I had a calling card. You remember those? Remember the calling card? It was Sprint or MCI. I mean, Google it, young people. And to get the cheaper rate, you had to wait to initiate the call after 9 p.m. Remember that? Nights and weekends. And somehow I still managed to spend it all, and it was worth it. Don't get me wrong. Oh, but kids today, wow. Now the cell phone companies basically give the minutes away for calling anybody, anywhere, at any time because the real money's in the data plan. It's the Electronic Tower of Babel, ladies and gentlemen. I remember a couple of different periodicals ran photo essays when President Obama was inaugurated, because part of what was symbolically important about President Obama's inauguration was that he represented more kind of the world citizen than previous U.S. presidents had because of the racial issues involved in this. But what's really interesting is in the photo essays you could call was people watching on TV the inauguration of the President of the United States all over the world. It's the electronic version of the Tower of Babel. There in London, somebody's watching on TV there. CNN's there. But it's not just London. It's Paris. And there's a bunch of people gathered around a large screen watching. But it's not just the first world. Because here in Nairobi, in Africa, there's a whole section of a city gathered around the one TV watching. And in Mexico City. And even more esoteric places like Baghdad, where again, you see the television screen in the corner, and they watch. Sarajevo, Afghanistan. In every picture, there's a TV. In every picture, there's the President of the United States being inaugurated. Not since Genesis chapter 11 has humanity been able to do things like this. The Super Bowl, one of the most watched events on the planet every year. The Super Bowl. It's interesting now, both Facebook and Google translate foreign pages. Language is an issue. We'll solve that with technology. And there's nothing new about this. What's really interesting is I remember a search engine some years ago called AltaVista. Some of you remember AltaVista? What's interesting is AltaVista's translation application had an interesting name. It was called Babelfish. Because they knew what they were doing. They knew the story. And technology was going to be the means of undoing it. And so now when I'm on Facebook, or I'm on Google, and I'm searching for something or reading somebody or click on somebody, and it comes up and it's another language, the website automatically offers a translation for me. Not since Babel has the human race been able to communicate and work together in real time, where even language is increasingly less and less of a barrier. And yet in our own day, it's happening again through technology. And I don't know about you, but I've read this story before. It's in the Bible, and it doesn't end well. In the end, it only serves to enable human rebellion. There's nothing wrong with it in and of itself. Because I can spread the gospel easier now, we always say. And that's great. But collectively for the human race, where does this generally go? It goes to a bad place. And so it's interesting in the Bible. What was God's response to the Tower of Babel? Well, we usually stop the story where I stopped reading a moment ago. God's response to the Tower of Babel was to confuse the languages and scatter them around the world. That's the part of the story that we remember. But God's response to Babel was more than that. God's response to Babel was the call of Abraham that actually starts at the end of chapter 11. But the part that we're more familiar with is in Genesis chapter 12. God calls Abraham. And God tells Abraham, go from your father's country and kindred to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and I will make your name great. And that's the part that I find interesting in light of Babel, right? What were they doing about? Well, they were going to make a name for themselves. What does God promise Abraham instead? You do it my way and what will happen? I'll give you the name that all men seek, that humans in a rebellion seek to make for themselves, redefine themselves. You submit to me. You fear me. You follow me. Rather than stealing a name or making a name, I'll give you a name so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and those who dishonor you, I will curse. And in you, not in Babel, not in technology, but in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. It's interesting. His name back then was Abram. God does make a name for him. God does give him a name. Remember, he changes his name to what we now know as Abraham. But what's really interesting is, again, there's a subtle repudiation of Babel and the Babel impulse among human beings. In Genesis chapter 11 and verse 6, behold, they are one people. Most translations say they are one people in Genesis 11, verse 6. In Hebrew, that word is Am, the same word that God appends to Abraham's name to turn him into Abraham. You don't see it in English, but it's there in Hebrew. They were one people. God decides to make his own kind of one people. To bring, think about it, in the gospel, to bring all nations together in one man. United not in rebellion against God, but united in submission to him through Jesus of Nazareth. And so God's response to Babel was to call Abram. And the Bible makes a big deal about this. In Genesis 17, when Abram's name is changed, Nehemiah, centuries later, when they're reminding themselves of the story that the God who chose Abraham brought him out of the Chaldeans and gave him that name, Abraham. Here's the bottom line. God's response to Babel, to human arrogance, to human technology, was to call Abram out of the city. To call him out of the city. To make a name for him instead of taking a name like human beings are prone to do. And what we forget, ladies and gentlemen, is that that's really our story still today. We are still heirs of his covenant and blessing today. Paul puts it this way in Galatians chapter 3. Know then that those who are of faith are the sons of Abram. Are the sons of Abram. And we're still being called out of Babel today, metaphorically speaking. We're still being called out of the human city and human ambition and human arrogance. And too often what human technology, the uses to which it is often put, and the arrogance that it often subtly teaches us. In Hebrews chapter 11, the Hebrew writer shows us that he got this out of his reading of Genesis. Hebrews chapter 11. Have your Bible. Hebrews chapter 11. Beginning of verse 7. Verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed, going out to a place which he was to receive for inheritance. He went out not knowing where he was going. And by faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob. For he was looking for here's what the Hebrew writer says. He was looking for a city. He wanted something different than what Babel represented. He was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Dropping down to verse 13, all these died in faith without having received the promise, without having seen them, having welcomed them from a distance, having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. Verse 16, but as it is, they desire a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, because he has prepared a city for them. Instead of building one like Cain did, like they did in Babel, God gives the city to his people and to those who submit and follow him. Three quick points, and we'll be through for this morning. And this big picture view of technology in the Bible and where it often leads and what it's often a big part of. What's the point? Three quick observations. Back in Genesis chapter 11 at Babel, at the Babel point, God said this is just the beginning when he decided to disperse them, when he decided to reject them in their rebellion. And their rebellion against them. This is just the beginning. This is just the tip of the iceberg, God says. I can see where this is headed, and it's not good. I need to stop this. And so I'm going to confuse their languages. I'm going to scatter them. And they're going to have to build lots of cities. They're going to have to spread themselves around the face of the earth. This is not good. When humanity gets together, one voice, one way, one technology, one idea, this is not good. There's a lot about Babel that is similar to our own time. We have the human race united through technology in ways that have not been possible since Genesis chapter 11, but we live in that time now. And so here we are. I want you to think about our situation this morning, the people I'm talking to in this room. Here we are this morning, and we live in a time where we have this extreme affluence. We eat well. I'm not talking about you don't have to struggle sometimes. I'm not talking about money's not tight sometimes. I'm talking about by world standards and by historical standards, we are all of us rich because all of us are eating lunch today. So we live in this extreme abundance in our country. Part of the problem is that we don't even see this extreme abundance anymore. We think we're just normal, we're average, or just getting by. And so we live in this extreme abundance in our country in this time and this place. We don't pray, therefore, for our daily bread anymore because we've got 2 weeks' worth in the pantry and a 20-cubic-foot freezer in the garage. Famine is what happens to other people, not us. The days when our great-grandparents got an orange or an apple for Christmas and were grateful for it are long gone. We're not even in our technology, in our time, in our place, we're not even subject to the natural cycles of planting and harvesting anymore. You could go into the grocery store right now, today. You can go into the grocery store at any time of the year and get any kind of produce fresh from the field thanks to modern agribusiness and transportation industries and technologies. We never anymore say, well, you know what, that's the last of the strawberries till next year. Or, boy, I sure can't wait for the corn harvest. It's all there, all the time, as much as you want of it, whenever you want of it. In our country, people take food for granted. We throw it away. We waste it. Our kids refuse to eat it if it doesn't taste good or isn't cooked the right way or mom forgot to cut the crust of the bread off again. For most of human history, food was scarce and the harvest was vulnerable and wealth was counted in how much you got stored up. But now we don't even really envy each other over food because we, all of us, eat better than ancient kings could ever dream of. Cinnamon was a spice. I got 3 bottles of it in my pantry because I bought too much accidentally. Cinnamon used to be rare and valuable. You could trade it for a car. So now, instead for us, it's house size. It's how new the car is. And especially for our young people, it's what latest gadgets they don't have that others do. Get this and get this well. We don't worry about food because we don't worry about survival anymore. Technology has freed us in one sense from the curse. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat bread. Oh, Jeff, I work hard for my money. Yeah, you do. But you know what? Most of us are working in air conditioning, and most of us are working for something bigger, better, or nicer. We're not really working for the food as such anymore, generally speaking. We've used technology to undo the curse, at least up until the part about returning to the dust from which we were taken. We've taken ourselves and our time and our place so close to Eden again that it's never been more like Babel before. And now look, as a society, what we begin to do. Look at us with our technology. We're still never satisfied. It's still never enough. We eat too much. We work too much. We covet too much. We want too much. It's never enough. And then what do we do with it? What do we do with it all? Mindless entertainment. We veg on the couch. We play video games endlessly and selfishly, because we'd have too little time for each other. This is just the beginning, God says, when I get to this point. I have to do something about it. Christians have to be wiser and understand what's going on and what we may get sucked up in if we're not critical and careful about what we do. Number two, as I've alluded to earlier, we need to choose the wise thing, and not just the moral thing or the legal thing. All things are lawful, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. Let no one seek his own good, but the good of his neighbor. It's not just whether it's right for you to do it, it's how does it affect other people. You know, one of the things that I've tried to become more conscious of is that my kids don't see me texting while I'm driving. Or they don't see me having to pull my cell phone out of my pocket every time I've got 30 idle seconds in the grocery store checkout line. Because I'm teaching them how to be an addict too. Not be able to help ourselves. That's why Paul, the Bible says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Wisdom looks at not just whether something is legal or moral, but whether it helps us further toward our purpose. Well, what is our purpose? Because that's the thing, too often we don't think about what is our purpose, what is our goal. Part of our goal is to raise wise and godly children. We sit there too often, we say there's nothing wrong with it, we let them participate. Instead, we need to be saying, ladies and gentlemen, that my goal is to raise God-fearing children. That's my goal, to raise God-fearing children who seek the kingdom first in all things, with all holiness and seriousness and maturity and spiritual wisdom. And will this, whatever this is, will this help or hurt them in the pursuit of holiness under the fear of God? And we need to think about that. We need to answer that question wisely rather than saying, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with the internet in and of itself as long as my kids aren't looking at porn. And thirdly, which kind of segues to next time, we become what we love, and what we use shapes us. We become what we love, and what we use shapes us. Jeremiah chapter 10. He's talking about idolatry, but it makes the point just as well. Thus says the Lord, learn not the way of the nations, nor be dismayed at the signs of the heavens, because the nations are dismayed at them. That's how they look at reality. That's how they look at nature. They worry about omens and signs. You don't think the way the world thinks about nature, about the world, about reality, about what it's for, about how it's used. You don't think the way that the nations think. Because the customs of the people are vanity. Think about it. A tree from the forest is cut down and worked with an axe by the hands of a craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nail so that it cannot move. Their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field. They can't speak. They have to be carried because they can't walk. Don't be afraid of them. They can't do evil, nor is it in to do good for that matter either. To which the prophet responds, there is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great in might. You become what we love shapes us, and you become like what you use. That was the joke that Jeremiah is picking up on here. Their idols and their view of God kind of reduced what they were as human beings. Reduced them to emptiness and to nothingness. Reduced them. At the end of the day, they were reduced to a view of God that was shaped by what an idol could contain. Their view of reality was limited by a pagan imagination rather than worshiping a God who can do abundantly above all that we can ask or think. Maybe that's why their faith was so weak so often. Because they were used to thinking about the world through the work of their own hands. The idol is it shapes how they think. It shapes how they interact with the world. Idolatry impacts how they view reality. So does technology. What is our purpose? Is our purpose here to take the stuff of the earth and build computers and TV screens out of it and become devoted to that, mesmerized by that, reduced to couch potatoes? Or are we made out of something that's God's own stuff, the Spirit of God in us? He breathed the breath of life into the first man, and every human since then has been supported by God's own life. Or do we spend all our time and all our interest to be shaped by the things of our own devising, like technology? Or do we need to be more careful of being shaped by God's things and God's way and God's thinking? That's the big picture issue. Nothing wrong with it in and of itself. But you begin to use it too much and too carelessly, and it begins to shape you into its own image. Just like Israel was reduced to the level of its own idols. It's a subtle but profound warning about the psychology of idolatry. You don't need to put up a little statue in your house to be addicted by the dynamic. Technology will do it just the same. Reduce your world, make it smaller, teach you the wrong ideas about reality, and ultimately direct your gaze away from the God in whose image you were made, in whose image you bear. All right, I've gone long this morning. You've listened well. I appreciate your letting me abuse you a little bit this morning in this. But I pray that we all think carefully about the big picture worldview that the Bible is trying to call us back to. It's not just a matter of is it right or is it wrong, and what websites is my kid on. There's something big going on here that the Bible warns us about. We'll talk more specifically about that next week. But before we're through this morning, I want to offer the gospel's call to anybody here this morning needs to get right with God. You're here this morning. You need to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, enter into his kingdom, and leave the world kingdom behind. Leave Babel for the heavenly city that Abraham pursued. We'll help you with that this morning. Confess Jesus as Lord, Savior, Son of God. Repent of your participation of the world and the sins that you've committed. We'll baptize you for forgiveness of your sins. You're here this morning. You're a child of God already. But you're back to Babel's project of making a name for yourself, doing life your way. Pray to God for forgiveness. We can pray with you for you anyway. Hold you accountable. Let us know while we stand. Always.